You're listening to Two Dudes, One Disc, where the most sought-after music journalists, the greatest minds in the history of... You really gonna make me read this
Just read it!
Take on the most influential albums of all time. Here's your host, Michael Heidemann, on Two Dudes, One Disc.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome into the newest episode. We're back. Two Dudes, One Disc. If you're tuning in for the first time, this is your go-to spot for coverage of your favorite albums from front to back. We dive into every single song of your favorite artists from A to ZZ Top. And I'm stoked to be back here. This is the returning episode. We're no longer called by that old name. It's a new year. It's a new time, and hell yes, it's a new album with the Mars Volta Deloused in the Comatorium. This is your host, Mike Heidemann, and I'm here with two of my favorite podcast hosts in the entire world. If you haven't tuned in to theirs, No Coast Cinema, you need to do it right now. It's on WGN Plus. They're the movie experts, and today I got them for a little bit of time to speak about one of their favorite albums. Welcome in, Tom Hush.
Yo.
And Connor Cornelius.
Hey.
Perfect.
Gotta go on the
guys.
Offbeat.
So what are we listening to today, guys? How's it going?
Going great. Thank you so much for having us on, Mike. Especially to talk about something that I feel I'm more qualified to talk about than the show that perhaps that we host.
Yeah. No, he is the consummate Mars Volta aficionado. He really is. I think I know maybe one other person who knows as much as Connor about the Mars Volta, but he's kind of like my shepherd into a lot of the background stuff. Wow. 'Cause I just really like the music, and then Connor helps me understand some of the other concepts that are going on, 'cause this is like some meaty stuff in terms of music.
Yeah, even before we started the podcast, listening to you guys kind of wax poetic about this album, I was getting more and more amped up, because as a young person in high school, when I was listening to this album for the first time, I didn't know that there were so many levels to this band. And now, ever since they put this album in 2003, there's been so much more folklore behind the band. Will they break up? When they come back together? It's this huge thing. So what was it about the Mars Volta, Connor, that kind of drew you to the band?
So my friend Ryan Arliscus, I remember we were driving around during summer one time, and I was like playing some, I can't remember what band I was playing. It was maybe like a Fallout Troy, like EP or something, the Ghost Ship demos, okay. I think. And we were listening to it, and I was like, yeah, I kind of like some of this stuff. The screaming bugs me a little bit, just like the vocal delivery constantly assaulting me. Mm-hmm. And he was like, okay, well, why don't we try to put this on? I mean, you like the drummer and you like the guitar playing, and these guys were totally inspired by this band, the Mars Volta, which was the first time I'd ever heard it. And he put it on, and I remember thinking, like, hearing John Theodore's drum parts and hearing Cedric singing and everything, and I didn't like it at first, mm-hmm. but there was a worm almost that had stuck in me, and I was like, there's something to this, and there's like a learning curve almost to actually liking the band, at least for me, mm-hmm. it was. And I had to dig into why this band was making me feel the way that it was. Yeah. And now they are my favorite band, I have to say.
Mm. Wow. Now, are they still even together, though?
They are working together. I follow Cedric on social media, and it's a good follow. Sometimes he's just insane. so they're supposedly in the studio. I don't know. They work on stuff together all the time, though. They're like Frank Zappa levels of prolific.
Yeah,
they're like Frank Zappa, like that. You know.
Cool, cool, cool. So what's this first song we're listening to?
This song is called Inertiatic ESP, but the first one that we put on was called Sonnet Lumière. Which is, it's actually really surreal to listen to it, because the first two bits is you hear sound manipulation from a guy called Jeremy Michael Ward, and he was like very important in the band. The only person besides the singer and the guitar player who actually had any creative input in how the songs turned out,
mm-hmm.
in the songwriting process. They're the only guys that like write everything, even though they have a big band. Mm-hmm. And then the piano part starts with a guy called Ikey Owens, who... the guys from, you know, Cedric and Omar met. He played with Snoop Dogg. He played with Sublime. He was Jack White's piano player on the Lazaretto tour, and then he actually passed away several years ago, and so did Jeremy Michael Ward. So it's really kind of interesting to hear how the first two things that you hear on the album are band members that were so important to their sound in the band and have unfortunately passed away.
Man, that's always the worst part, you know, when you are at the top of your game, obviously, because this is an album that so many people have connected with, and it's hard to connect to an album, especially one that came out years ago, and then see that kind of talent just kind of, you know, need to go away. It's a shame.
Well, I mean, when you have a band like the Mars Volta, and especially two creative heads like Cedric Bixler-Zavala and Omar Rodriguez-Lopez, it's that sort of creative clash that produces some of their best music, yet is going to be the band's downfall. We see it in things like other progressive bands like Pink Floyd. You have David Gilmour, who, for my money, is one of the most beautiful and technically gifted guitar players of all time.
The Sultan of Sustain.
Yeah. He's a guy that knew exactly how he wanted to play every part, and he never really missed a note. He just played... He played for the song instead of just shredding, even though sometimes he shreds. Mm-hmm. And then you have Roger Waters, who is a fantastically gifted songwriter and conceptualist, who came up with some of the headier albums of the time. You know, we think of things like The Wall, we think of Animals, Dark Side of the Moon. A lot of that is of his construction, and putting them together creates some of the most important albums of that era, but it also creates a certain amount of creative clash and personal clash that results in the splitting of a once great group. Now, I'm personally a fan of some of their post-breakup stuff, both, you know, Pink Floyd, but also the Mars Volta. They've done some really interesting stuff following the demise of that band, but it never really reaches the same creative heights, if you ask me. I mean, Omar did, what, like 12 albums?
24.
He released 24 albums
in released biweekly over the course of 1 year. I think it was 2017.
Yeah.
For
Ipecac Records, which is run by... Who runs that?
It's the guy from Mr. Bungle, Mike Patton.
Yeah, Mike Patton from Faith No More.
Yeah, oh.
He runs this crazy label, Ipecac.
Yeah. You know, for that level of songwriting, that name fits it very well, because you are literally puking out music.
Yeah.
like every single week.
And it does, there is obviously, like I mentioned kind of earlier, Frank Zappa, right? There is obviously of various degrees of quality to what you can expect. But if you go on his, you know, you go on Omar Rodriguez Lopez's Wikipedia page, you'll just click on an album and it'll be like, this is the 342nd studio album by, you know, not that many, but
it's ridiculous. The guy was just turning out music left and right. And he just possesses such an insane level of creativity that does result in that, as you said, the varying degrees of quality, because not everything can be a zinger. A lot of it is kind of sketches, in a sense, like of what a good song could be. And a lot of it is stuff that was recorded years ago.
And then he decided to repurpose it. And now, Tom, do you think that this... I kind of have my own opinion on this record, The Louse and the Comatorium, but would you say that this is maybe their most solid work? Maybe not the best word, but most... conceptually sound piece of music?
I'd say probably yes, but also I think the Bedlam and Goliath reaches those levels of cohesiveness in a lot of ways, which was the first Mars Volta record I ever heard, which the Bedlam and Goliath, released in 2008. I heard that, and I really felt like I understood the concept through and through, and then I worked my way back and got to De Laust, but I would say probably if not Bedlam.
Well, it always comes down to, you know, it's just a wealth of work over years and years and years. Heartbreak, the girls, the guys, the jobs you got fired from, going all into this one album, and you like kind of, you know, put it out. So it's a really great album. Let's take a look at our next song, number 3, Roulette Dares.
And I do think this is their best song. I'll say this. I think all the way through, I think so.
I love that you use of just insane effects.
Yes.
Like the production on this album makes it, me, and I'm sure you guys as producers, your head spin.
Yeah,
like, dang,
absolutely.
Man. So we need to echo effect the drums right in the beginning. Then you want to go into reverb sounding with the vocals.
Yeah.
And then kick back into a clean set of drums with tied with the guitar. Oh, man, I'm already exhausted from it.
I'd really like to start talking about that. I'm so glad that you brought that up because the way that if people are fans of the Mars Volta or at least are somewhat like peripherally aware of them, they know that they make concept albums a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And narrative aside, most concept albums are just, you know, messes. But this was their first, just a little bit of history. This was produced by Omar Rodriguez Lopez, the guitar player, and Rick Rubin, famous for,
wow,
you know, bringing the Red Hot Chili Peppers together.
One
and
of the
actually,
most famous producers of all time.
And Flea actually plays bass on the entire album.
Really?
Yeah. Flea's the bass player on the entire album. But the way that, so look at, like, just imagine this. They come from their post-hardcore outfit at the drive-in.
Mm-hmm.
They're in a dub band for an odd number of years. And they land on a major label for their first time since At the Drive-In. And it's with Rick Rubin, the most legendary producer of the last 20 years and at the time. And then they're like, okay, well, here's what we're going to do for our first major, you know, studio album release on a major label. We're going to do an hour of music. It's going to be a concept album. And the way that they use guitar pedals, it actually kind of echoes the theme, I think, of the record. And they use effects that on paper are just barely usable. They're like one single-use kitchen implements, you know? It's a ring mod, which is that, like, filtering sound that you hear where it's like...
Yeah.
That thing. And they're really hard to use because what they basically are delay pedals that the echo is so quick that it actually sounds like it's detuning your instrument.
Mm.
And
I could see that. That's kind of like one of their signature sounds almost.
Absolutely. Mm. And it's just such a strange thing to me that they would be so... And they commit to it across the entire record. It's a recurring thing that they use. They use it all over his voice. They use it all over the guitar throughout the whole thing. And then that's what you hear in the beginning. And it transitions the second song into the third song, the ring mod. And then at the end, they use another notoriously impossible single-use kitchen implement effect in the robo-talk in Omar's, like, greatest guitar part ever, and just, like, this insane guitar break that's in, like, 1324 or some ridiculous time signature where he's speeding up the tempo in the riff and everything. Mm-hmm. And I just think that it's... whether you want to say sonically it's consistent or narratively if it's a mess, the thing I want to say most about it is it's really impressive that they commit to such like workmanlike, you know, such a workmanlike ethic from the outset with this record.
Wow, yeah, it's quite the extreme adventure. I mean, it was dedicated to, I guess, a friend of the lead singers, and it was kind of my first, going back to my own personal experience, it was my first time with somebody who said, "Hey, have you ever listened to math rock?" And I'm like, "What's math rock?
I'm not interested at first, but go on."
Yeah.
And then, like, slowly they're like, "No, the use of the time signature is just different than anything you'll ever hear." And there's all these other bands that are really great with it. I'm trying to think of some other groups, but I'm blanking on them now at the moment.
Well, I think the Dismemberment Plan, I know, is a really popular math rock or math implementing band.
You got contemporaries, label mates with the Mars Volta, Mastodon. They're famous.
Mastodon?
Doing some time signature stuff, although they obviously veer heavier into the more metal kind of stoner sludge sort of thing, but they think in those terms as well.
I bet you if the lead singer of Mastodon didn't have face tattoos and their guitarist and bassist didn't have long hair and they were just all clean cut dudes like from the Vampire Weekend, people would take them lot more seriously.
Well, you know what they would be? They'd probably be like American. they'd be like American Football, which is a legendary emo band. They use a lot of math rock staples. They're doing odd time signatures. They're doing kind of like this stuff that is ersatz and angular, but they do it through a lens of emo music. And really, you can hear a lot of that in especially the early Mars Volta. They're coming from At the Drive-In, which is post-hardcore, very emotional music, very heavily into those types of lyrics,
but very,
and it makes it
very rooted in punk rock still.
Absolutely.
And simplicity.
And this brings, I would almost call this like emo prog in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
This is not dudes singing about well, it is kind of them singing about the fabric of time, but like they're also doing it in an emotional way, telling a story that is rooted in playing with your heartstrings if you dig into it. I believe, I don't know if we've mentioned this, but the whole album is rooted around a story written by Cedric Bixler Zavala, the lead singer of the band, involving a guy who falls into a coma. Yeah,
called Kerpentaxt and Doloused in the Comatorium.
Wow. So, so I was reading up on this, and it says, I'm pulling this from a website called Remezcala, and it looks like it was kind of dedicated to an homage to Julio Venegas, an El Paso artist, poet, and close friend that Rodriguez Lopez and Bixler Zavala. And this man went into a coma after a deliberate drug overdose and then recovered, only then to die by suicide later on. But in 1996, he jumped off a freeway overpass and went right in rush hour traffic. There's a lot of heaviness to this album.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's one of those things where Omar and Cedric saw a lot of stuff in El Paso when they were growing up. They themselves were drug addicts. They used heroin throughout a good portion of their early years. And it's something that they've struggled with ever since.
Mm-hmm.
And they're clean now. They've been clean for a very long time. But these early records are really touched with a lot of tragedy and a lot of having to work through these mental states that they experienced, and seeing what happened to a lot of their good friends in the El Paso art scene. And you can hear that early on in At the Drive-In, and you can hear it in the Mars Volta. I would say no more so than Deloused.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit getting into their second album, Francis the Mute. But Deloused, if you want to hear the pain that they dealt with as young men, Deloused in the Comatorium is an excellent representation of that.
And if you do approach this album from a typical perspective, you know, you're listening to the lyrics to try to get the story or whatever, there are very few moments of clarity where he describes the scene of Julio standing on top of the, you know, freeway and everything. But it does kind of give me a idea of, like, they were working so hard, and there isn't a ton of clarity on this record. I mean, his lyrics are very imagery driven. But it almost gives me the feeling that they were, like, just trying to sweat it out, you know?
Yeah.
Like, sweat out the
grief. It's feverish.
It is.
It is like a fever dream at times. A really good fever dream, in a sense, because it just, the whole album, I mean, getting away from even just the themes of it, the whole album just rips.
It
is nonstop sheer creativity through in and throughout. And it's an album that can really affect you emotionally, or you can just honestly rock out to in your car.
Speaking of, let's jump into that next song. Is it Tírame a las?
Tírame a las arañas. Yeah, throw me to the spiders.
I'm so glad I have Connor and Tom here to help me through this album. Now, they do a very Pink Floyd-y kind of sensibility with these starts of their songs. Kind of lead you down a journey almost. A little pseudo-Spanish guitar there, right?
Yep.
Nice lead-in.
I do think that they're really important for bringing, like, Hispanic influences of Latin music into rock, progressive rock as well. And the way that I would describe it to people who don't really know them is, what if Led Zeppelin had Santana in the band? That's kind of how I view them a little bit.
That's a good way to look at it.
And it's
That'd
weird.
Be one hell of a band, too.
Right? I know.
And you can even hear, like, if you go back and listen to Santana at Woodstock with some of the jams that he's doing in Latin beats, you'll hear a lot of that in this, but obviously filtered through their own harder punk sort of aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
So all these sounds that you're hearing, that's Jeremy Michael Ward just doing sound manipulation. And they at their live shows, which were notoriously, you know, raucous, he would actually have a big pedal board that's like filtering Cedric's vocals and filtering Cedric's guitar through different things, and really gave it kind of a unique idiosyncratic live experience to separate it from the album experience.
Oh, that was beautiful.
Yeah.
And then it goes into another song.
Yeah.
So a little peek behind the curtain. We're listening to it online, not listening to it all the way through, but here we go with the next song, The Drunken Ship of Lanterns.
So yeah, you get that Latin vibe, you know, with the bongos and everything, and just sort of that, like the rhythm of the drums is very. It's very much that. It is literally that. No,
well, it's one of those bands where
it's
you
like
can
a
kind
salsa
of,
beat.
Yeah, you can describe. Like, it's so much fun to describe what they're doing just with, like, mouth noises.
Sugarabugadas, yeah. Onomatopoeias.
Well, when I was, okay, so when I was 16 and listening to this in high school, like, I was like, this band is so freaking busy.
Oh, yeah.
It's like everything that they're doing is just, there's so much that's going into it. And at that time, I was listening to Fall Out Boy, The Reunion Show. Mm-hmm. I mean, Coheed and Cambria, yes, but kind of after the Mars Volta is when I really got into them. But there was just so much music crammed into these songs that my young mind almost couldn't even handle it because they put so much work into these albums.
I would say one of my favorite things about the Mars Volta, and people ask me why I enjoy it, and there's levels with the lyrical content, with the song craft, but really I think my favorite thing is the way it makes me feel completely overwhelmed in a way that is unlike anything else. It is a truly maximalist approach to production.
Yeah.
It feels like a wave rushing over you, and I feel confused at times and disoriented, but in such a way that it's like euphoric.
It's therapy almost.
Therapeutic. Like I could pass out on the ground just like listening to this, in like a Christ-like pose, just taking it all in.
I think you're describing the first time you did mushrooms, Tom.
Honestly,
it's very much a drug experience.
It
a
very
lot of
much
all
is,
their records
yeah.
are
if,
very.
If you want to know what it's like to do some kind of like mushroom euphoric. Psychedelic drug. This is
you.
It.
Yeah. They'll take it for you.
Oh, and here's John Theodore.
Oh. Flea's also got some sick fills on this one.
Ooh.
This one. Oh wait, it's the next one. Just kidding. Here we go.
It's so powerful.
It really gets
right into your veins.
Yeah.
Almost.
And I do think that a lot of the things that we're talking about as pros for the music and why we like it so much could be at the very opposite end of the coin be used to criticize the band.
Totally.
I think that at a lot of the times that you'll see in their later albums, they kind of disappear up their own ass and it's very transparent.
Dude, okay. Yeah, man, you've been on that 18-minute guitar solo out of tune for the last give me a break. Can I just play bass once on the album?
Or like you mentioned, they never stop really. They're always constantly going full blast, pedal to the metal nonstop. The lack of dynamacy there, you could construe it as a lack of dynamacy, obviously, and the way that the singer is always singing very, very high up in his range and with a lot of emotional energy behind it. He's always, like, full on, fully emotional the entire time. There's no real, he's calming down, you know what I mean? Even when he's whispering, he's like, he's still like pent up and like pissed about something. And I fucking love it. I find it really inspiring.
Yeah, it's a really cool feeling that you get. And I picture, when I'm listening to these albums, I'm picturing the studio sessions that they're having.
Oh my God.
Because most of the time you kind of displace yourself from that.
Right.
And just seeing them be like, I need more wah on this.
Yeah.
And then the lead singer just sitting in the back just slamming espresso shots. Just like, I got to get
ready.
He's like,
okay, but what if we put a ring mod on this guy and then we put a Mellotron on the bass and more flanger? Yeah, yeah,
so
that's a good idea.
There's a famous story about Pink Floyd when they were creating their albums. And they were at the height of their fame and they could do no wrong in most people's eyes. And they actually wanted to create an album made of purely of kitchen sounds. Hmm. Like purely of just, forks clamming together and doors slamming. And they could make a full album and put some guitars behind it. And the producer nearly lost his mind and it went to hell and they scrapped it forever after they spent a week on trying to get a rubber band snap correct.
I mean, that's what you get when you have these types of people. They're generally very obsessive about what they're trying to do, which can be both a positive and a negative. You know, since we do host No Coast Cinema, I do want to tie it back to a great scene in an amazing movie, Walk Hard: The Dewey Cox Story.
Yes,
which I think is outside of This Is Spinal Tap, one of the most cutting satirizations of music, and specifically music biopics. But there's a bit where he goes full Brian Wilson and he's just recording sounds of literally anything. Like he puts a microphone up to a woman's naked breasts to like record that. But then there's a bit where he goes up to these African bushmen,
mm-hmm.
and they're all, you know, in their ceremonial garb and everything. And he goes up to them and he's just like, "Listen, you're African bushmen. Sound like fucking bushmen." Like, and he just freaks out. And it's really, really a cutting satirization of those type of people.
It's so true. And he's like, "I'll need more didgeridoo.
Yeah.
I want a whole army of didgeridoos."
"I've got a vision up the ass, and you don't stand in my way, okay?
I've got a new idea of music. I call it schmusic." That's again what, as Connor said, people can listen to this and definitely get that impression that these are just two dudes on heroin making an insane racket. There's plenty of people I've tried to get into the Volta that are just like, "I hate this because it's so confusing and it's so erratic, and it's drug like at times where
Absolutely.
You're just like, it's manic, it's insanity. How can anyone parse through this?" But if you're willing to give it the time to especially appreciate, like when they like they're in Drunkship of Lanterns, some of those drum fills are just that.
They're very much like that. Yeah,
awesome.
Or how about that drum break in Roulette Dares? Like,
and now you can probably imagine us in high school, because this is, I mean, we met in high school and we discovered the Mars Volta roughly the same time, I would say.
Yeah.
And this is literally how conversations go. Like, "Yeah, do you really like that part where he's like squealy diddle wow?" Yeah. Like,
and we are trying to. We are on film here. We are being recorded. Yes, yes, you can only imagine that we are.
This is going out to 100,000 people right now.
Oh, so boy!
I've been doing air drums for the last 15 minutes. So.
Yeah. Well, so, hopefully they're entertained.
Oh man! All right, let's take a quick look at the next song real quick. Pull it up here.
Is it Area Tarka?
Still not finished yet. I'm hearing more Aboriginal percussions. And I want an army of didgeridoos. 50,000 didgeridoos.
Folks, can we have a moment with Dewey?
This totally.
I can just see it. I can just see it.
I wanted to know a little bit about you guys, actually. So when you guys met in high school, a lot of my friends came the same exact way. We pull up an album. I saw a guy with a patch on his backpack of MXPX, and I'm like, "I love that band too."
Oh,
and we
yeah.
kind of connected together. Do you remember the first album you guys got connected over? Like when you're like, "Whoa, who's this Tom guy?"
Was it during our ska phase?
Yeah, because I was in a ska band in high school that we hung out a fair amount around those shows. I do have a one memory, and I honestly think that it was me and you and Tiger Cat before we were going to pick up our friend Nate and Steven mm-hmm. to go hang out, and we were on the way to go pick up Steven, and this was before, because on the way back, we turned on Turnberry Trail, and I'm playing Roof with a Hole by the Meat Puppets.
Yeah.
And that was the first moment. Tom was sitting in the front seat, and he turns to me, and we didn't know each other very well, and he turns to me and he goes, "Connor, you've got good taste in music." And I was like, "I like this guy." I just thought to myself, like, this guy gets me.
Meat Puppets rule. Aww. I love.
See, you do have a soundboard.
Well, do you guys not use the soundboard in No Coast?
No,
oh my
should.
God, we really should.
We're trying to get a James Hetfield only soundboard, so just yeah.
Love James Hetfield, but yeah, no, it seemed he and I connecting over music came pretty naturally, I would say.
Yeah.
And as he mentioned, it was because we were hanging around the same people who were in bands. And I was never in any of these bands. I was kind of like almost I was the guy who's probably in the background of like the live photo that's in the liner notes to be like, "Oh yeah, that's Tom. Like, I remember him from the scene,"
or
from the Crystal Lake
You're not
scene.
Giving yourself enough credit. You were the guy emceeing the events.
Oh yeah. Yeah,
see,
that was
hype man.
That was something that I did. And I almost saw myself as someone who would have been documenting the scene, although I absolutely didn't because I was too busy fucking drinking and smoking pot with these idiots. Like, But like,
if you only had a camera though,
yeah,
attached to that J. Man.
If I'd been more of a photographer, I really would have spent more time documenting that specific time. Because I think I'm sure you had a similar experience. You're from McHenry.
Yeah.
Not far from us.
No. Yeah, we grew up in Crystal Lake.
Yeah, yeah. Grew up in Crystal Lake.
And shout out Northwest Suburbs.
Yeah, Northwest Suburbs, man. But it was one of those things where it's not like McHenry and Crystal Lake are like, you know, desolate or anything like that, but it's kind of like strip mall hell.
Yeah,
especially Crystal Lake. You know, Route 14 is just it's Route 14,
like 47,
and then
Woodstock and shit.
Right, but I'm thinking of over what's the street where the Guitar Center is. You know, going towards 90.
Oh, you're thinking of
31.
It's not Rackow. Randall Road and Route 14, which are kind of two opposite streets where you would drive down, you know, all the time.
That was a thing to do. Like if you were 16, you would drive up and down those streets.
Exactly. Yeah. You're just cruising. Like it's literally like American Graffiti. You're just driving. You've got nothing to do. You're probably going to go over to Country Donuts and hang outside and smoke cigarettes for a few hours because you've got no money. You can afford a cup of coffee, maybe. And you know, when people would shows,
you weren't around the clock, fellas.
That was after the show.
Honestly, we were Country Donuts people. There were crowds. We ran it. Those were distinct crowds, though, for sure. You know,
yeah,
yes, and Steak and Shake.
Oh, Steak and Shake.
And then what was the place? Colonial Cafe.
Colonial Cafe.
The kitchen sink.
Mm-hmm. That was my place. Anyway, I digress. So go right ahead.
But I mean, it's all interesting because we have these shared experiences of growing up in these places and shared experiences of the music scene for. Whatever it was basically our escape from a really crushing sense of suburbia.
Yeah. Right.
That at very least, I don't know about you guys, I definitely felt at times that I was just like, I feel so trapped in this place that is not a bad place to be. Mm-hmm. I'm not growing up in poverty. I'm not growing up in
that's
a place
the thing,
where I'm
right?
afraid of violence. Yeah.
It's almost the guilt of the genuine emotions that you're feeling. You are like yourself kind of blaming yourself for feeling the way that you naturally feel. Because
we
strange.
Were, yeah, we were just like, wow, there's really nothing to do because it's just, this is it. It's if you're not shopping, what are you doing?
Right.
Yeah. And Crystal Lake has changed a lot over the years. And I feel like the downtown Crystal Lake, the main street has become more lively. And I really give credit to all the many people that try to keep Crystal Lake's, you know, independent commerce alive. But, you know, we grew up there. We were born in the 90s and grew up in late 90s, early 2000s, where, again, strip mall hell. It was just nonstop development of all these stores that nobody wanted. And
it's crazy to think how you grew, like I myself grew up in that kind of where all these brick and mortar stores were going up, Borders Books and, you know, the Myers, the Targets. And you're like, this isn't going to go anywhere. We're going to be like the booming, bustling place that Chicago is one day. Sure. And now it's just empty stores.
Yeah. Oh, it's so freaky. There's like a Dominic's that I used to go to all the time. Gone. Borders. Gone.
Gone.
All these places that you considered like, oh, this will never go out of business. And then you realize that the 90s are over, man. It's done. Like 2008 hits in Crystal Lake. It was bad. A lot of people. But
move on with your life, Tom.
I know.
All right, quit living in the past.
Let's dive into the next song real quick and we'll continue it.
I think this is the best song on the record, but it's high up there with Area Tarka, up there with Roulette Dares, but god damn it. This is like an At the Drive-In song.
The amount of money these guys must have spent on that pedal board. Song is different.
Yeah.
It is. But I love what you brought up about growing up in small suburban towns. And I think this is why the Mars Volta connects with a lot of people who grew up in that time is because you grew up in a city where it seemed like everything was buzzing around your head, but there was nothing you can do about it besides just put your headphones on sometimes and just listen to some good music.
It's very escapist. Is, yeah.
Yeah. Very escapist.
It helps bring like a therapeutic approach to the insanity that you're feeling. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And it's just like, it's okay that you're feeling this way because we're just being insane for no goddamn reason as well. And it's like, let's just join in with us.
Yeah.
Join in with the experience and just let it happen.
Man, it's so deep when we're going into this Mars Volta album. It's bringing out a lot of emotion from me, actually. This is a very emotional album that, to be honest, I haven't heard a lot of these songs like all the way through.
Oh, yeah.
Since, you know, for at least 10, 15 years.
Mm-hmm. So this chorus is really good.
Yeah. feel
the
like
drumming, the drumming on that
so
is unbelievable,
good.
Man. It, fucking it, unbelievable.
They, this band is blowing me away. I mean, looking back at this album, it reminds me of watching those Warped Tour videos or going to Warped Tour and hearing these guys in the background and thinking, oh my gosh, it's probably so sweaty and moshy over there right now. I have images of just mud being thrown every time I listen to this album.
And Cedric is notorious for just doing crazy onstage antics, like climbing shit, jumping off of things,
throwing things into the audience.
Yeah, there was a performance once at the MTV. It was like MTV Awards or something.
And Zach De La Rocha does the introduction to them. Zach De La Rocha of the Rage Against the Machine band. The Rage Against the Machine.
But at one point, Cedric and they were performing Drunkship of Lanterns, which we heard a little bit earlier. And Cedric literally climbs into the audience and is climbing over people
seated.
Over chairs. And he grabs a dude's sunglasses and puts them in his mouth, and he's singing into the microphone, just going absolutely insane.
And then he just walks on stage. He stole a guy's sunglasses on national television.
Probably like $500 sunglasses. And stole them, put them in his mouth, and tossed them.
When you
rock and roll.
To kind of just use Zach De La Rocha's words, he talks about how the band, when they play live, they did seem to make a very concerted effort to separate the experience of them watching them live from this album, from the album experience, because they have multiple. And he says that, like, borrowing showmanship notes almost from, like, the MC5 and bands like that from the 70s and the 80s and, like, punk, you know, punk rocks like Black Flag that didn't give a shit about playing the songs perfectly, but gave you moments where you could really get the feeling that you were watching something very human that was happening on stage that could not be, that was only happening in that moment in time and would never be repeated ever again until they go on stage and do it again.
And that's what rock and roll is, though, right? Creating those moments in someone else's life. You know, I play music in the city. I know you guys do as well. And when you're on stage, often I'm finding, after you get over the initial sense of being nervous in front of playing in front of your friends or strangers, it's all about finding that moment and living in that present moment. And there's, honestly, you look back at the footage of this band, and there's really no other band that lived so much more in the moment than this. They never could just going through the steps, like, oh, we got to go on stage and play this song again. They left at the drive-in to create more music and create a different kind of sound. It was all just very, what's the word I'm looking for? It was all very
spontaneous
and present. Like they were there to create this sound, and that's what they did.
Yeah.
So it's really awesome to see like the evolution over 16 years that this album came out.
Yeah. I think it's worth mentioning. You mentioned the drumming, especially here on Area Tarka. John Theodore, one of the best drummers to ever play. The guy had just a complete mastery of his instrument, and
he plays with Queens of the Stone Age now.
Yeah, he plays with Queens
still
of the Stone
around.
Age now. Yeah, he's still doing
really?
It. Yeah,
ah, he's the new drummer on their new record.
Yeah, but
one of the tightest bands in all of history. They are the most amazing musicians. Like seeing them live, not a single note is off. It's like everything is perfectly set. It's like almost you're listening to a tape.
Yeah.
Yeah, at times.
They are bad at it. I fucking love Queens of the Stone Age. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they got John Theodore in there just shows that Josh Homme knows his shit.
Yeah. I would say if you like Queens of the Stone Age, you will probably like the Mars Volta for the riffs. Because the riffs are
absolutely
thick.
The songs are kind of structured similarly. It's like they do it very pop format, you know, verse, chorus, verse, chorus, outro, whatever, bridge, chorus,
and
outro, whatever.
And that's the thing, is that the Mars Volta is founded on pop sensibility.
Exactly. They're a pop band. And they would say that themselves, I think, probably.
Yeah, and I'm reading up a little bit on the lead singer. He says that he would listen to his music and everything was just cycled through the feeling of salsa music.
Yeah,
he says
absolutely.
That he hears a lot of things with clave in his head, like ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. And you can kind of, in learning and listening to the album more and more, I can see that's probably the case. Let's move on to the next song, though. Cicatriz.
Cicatriz. Which means scar in Spanish.
Let's take a listen.
And this song is notable because features synthesizer and vocals from John Frusciante.
Oh.
Not right here, but it's in the chorus.
You know, you're mentioning a lot of the people who are involved in Mars Volta. Let's just do a quick rundown of the list that I found here of band members. Notably, this is on Wikipedia, but the final lineup that happened in July of 2012, this was around that time, Omar, Rodriguez Lopez, Cedric Bixler Zavala, Juan Adrente?
Juan Adrente de la Peña.
He was there too.
Yes,
Marcel Rodriguez Lopez, D'Antoni Parks.
D'Antoni, yep.
D'Antoni Parks. Then we got the Conformer contributors, keyboardist Isaiah Ikea Owens, Linda Good. Sound manipulators. There's not a lot of bands that have a specific list of sound manipulators. Jeremy Michael Ward, Paul Hinojos.
Paul Hinojos, yes.
Hinojos.
I think he was from At the Drive-In, right? Or am I getting that wrong?
That
Paul Hinojos. Wait, is he in Hella?
He's on Omar's solo album Cryptomnesia
with Hella.
And he was the bass guitarist for At the Drive-In too.
Oh, yeah, I see. Yeah, that is, okay, that's where he came
that
from.
That is correct. John Fugasante. And he was on guitar.
John Frusciante.
Frusciante from the Chili Peppers.
The man that launched 1,000 Strat sales.
Yeah.
Are you right?
I mean, basically.
Yeah.
Bassist Eva Gardner, Flea, Jason Ralph Jasso, Jason Letter. We got Blake Fleming, John Theodore, Thomas
Pridgen.
Pridgen?
Yep.
Pridgen? Dave.
The Pigeon.
The Pigeon. is somewhat known. I don't know.
That guy's
stupid.
Ass.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you ever met any of these guys in the Mars Volta before?
No, man. I saw At the Drive-In one time on their tour.
We saw them, right?
Yeah, we saw them together. Yeah, and you got to see Anti-Mask, which was kind of like their first thing after breaking up the Mars Volta.
Yeah. Both of those projects were just still...
very much in their infancy.
Yeah. And it was Cedric and Omar still working together. None of the rest of the members of the Mars Volta, except for, Dave Elitch played drums on Anti-Mask, and he was a guy that toured with them. He never appeared on a recording, I don't believe. Yeah. But Dave Elitch played with them. It's funny because when you look on the records, if you look at who the Mars Volta, it says the Mars Volta are Cedric Bixler Zavala and Omar Rodriguez Lopez. Mm-hmm. The Mars Volta group are, and then it's the rest of them.
Yeah.
So technically, the Mars Volta is just those two people. If you were to have them and a bunch of different musicians, they could really still call themselves the Mars Volta and it would be accurate, because technically it's one of those things where it's like John Coltrane is the artist and then he has
the group is the quartet. That's how Omar Rodriguez Lopez structured the band.
Well, he was the leader and he's the best at what he does. And by the way, I totally apologize for screwing up and hacking up all those names.
I've done it a million times.
That's
it's
the
so
main
hard.
Thing that that people write in about. They're like, you don't know anything about the band. it's like you have like a 2-hour conversation about an album and then you get one name wrong and it's like, what, it's Bono, not Bono.
Well, look, those people would mess up things too if they were having to host albums that about things that they weren't super familiar with.
That's very true. Let's jump into the next song real quick. The Apparatus Must Be Unearthed.
Yeah, this song's
it's crazy.
It's good.
It's good. It's good. The sound of bees with guitar.
Ah, wonderful.
Kind of, though, yeah.
Let them lull you to sleep. Brace yourselves. It doesn't stop.
How many movies has this song been in?
Because, zero.
really? Yeah, good
it
question.
It sounds like an opening trailer song.
Yeah.
Where shit's about to hit the fan, and this song pops on, and you're like, oh my God, that guy's running through the alley, pulling things. It's a very theatrical song, I feel like.
It's funny. As far as I'm aware, the only movie that has used the Mars Volta is Get Him to the Greek, and they don't even use it. It's the last track on this album, but it's one of their live versions where they do an extended version.
Yeah.
And Cedric hits these insane notes.
Do you remember, have you seen Get Him to the Greek?
Of course.
So you know
it's
the
that,
bit
like it's that the bit Jonah Hill's doing. That's what he's doing. He's doing the Mars Volta.
He's trying to convince his girlfriend to come to a Pixies Mars Volta show, which was an actual tour.
Happened.
Oh.
Yeah, my uncle saw that tour. My uncle was in California on that tour, and he's just like, "Hey, do you want to go see Pixies and Mars Volta?" And oh my God, who is it? It's the girl from The Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah, I can't remember her name.
Her name.
Oh, yes. I know who you're talking about. I can see her face.
Yeah.
She's in Us.
Yeah. Nick's gonna kill me. Nick DiGiulio is gonna kill me for not remembering your name. Elizabeth Moss.
There it is.
But yeah, he's just like, she's just like, who's the Mars Volta again? And he plays like this ridiculous section, and he does the. that's the only time I think it's been used in a movie. Omar has scored some movies.
Yeah, he did a
Sentimental Engine Slayer, which is a small movie.
He did a movie that Mark Ruffalo made called Sympathy for Delicious, and D'Antoni, their last drummer, actually was in that movie, and I think they made some songs for it.
Yeah,
Omar has also worked with who's the guy that did the score for Blade Runner 2049?
Hans Zimmer.
He did a score with Hans Zimmer for a movie called The Burning Plains.
Oh, wow.
And I don't know if it ever got released. But
guys, if you aren't listening to No Coast Cinema, the extent of these two guys' knowledge is just incredible. Incredible.
Well, thank you.
Oh, my gosh. So these guys have a very big repertoire when it comes to working with movies, music.
Absolutely.
Acting. Mm-hmm. Man. Well, you can tell they're just creative guys.
Totally.
They can kind of do whatever they want.
Yeah, they're just two big creative guys with like some of the best hair in the game.
Yeah, absolutely.
Seriously, how much conditioner is used in their hair?
They're bringing the perm back, for real.
they really are.
Is coconut oil involved? Probably.
Oh, we can only hope so.
Let's listen to the next song. Oh, sorry to interrupt.
Oh, I was just going to say...
is it about hair? How much coconut oil do you
keep talking about hair?
I was just going to say, their look is like very important, but I know they jokingly refer to themselves as Latin Danzig.
Well, Cedric does.
Cedric does. And then he calls Omar. He likes to call Omar
Puerto Rican Bernie Sanders.
No, he calls him Puerto Rican Woody Allen.
Woody Allen, yeah, because he's also a filmmaker. Yeah. Omar is and has made a bunch of movies that premiered at Sundance.
He kind of looks like Woody Allen if he were Puerto Rican.
Yeah, he just recently referred to him as the Puerto Rican Bernie Sanders. So I think that's the new Mars Volta super fans. That's what we have to refer to him as.
So we're listening to Televators right now. It's a very ethereal kind of atmospheric. Pink Floyd-y kind of opening with I'm guessing they really dug. I mean, you can see the influences of what went into the Mars Volta before they put together this album. But I want to see, what kind of conversations do you think they were having, the lead singer and his bandmates when he's like, hey, should we do the bee noise in the beginning on this song, or should it be saved for the next one?
Well, I think that probably had a lot to do with their collaboration between Jeremy Michael Ward, Omar Rodriguez Lopez, Jeremy Michael Ward, and Cedric. They probably were just, they wanted to do whatever it was that struck them in the moment. I think, like, if it made them feel good, they wanted to use it.
Yeah.
And that is reflected in a lot of their choices musically and in life, for better or worse. And I think that it's obviously hard to it is ultimately speculation, but what do you think, Tom?
I would say, at the very least, we can say for certain that there was almost no conversation between that trio and the rest of the band.
Yes, I think we can surmise that.
Yeah, they're notorious for, especially Omar on later albums, would essentially write the parts and have everybody record them independently. And not he wouldn't tell them what it was supposed to sound like. He wouldn't tell them what the rest of the song would sound like. He would just be like, hey, John, I want you to play this part. Play a drum beat in this time signature. And he would kind of piecemeal it together. He would throw them on top of it, which gives a very interesting
It's like
chaos.
A Miles Davis approach to creating an album, which I think he only did on Francis the Mute.
He did that on Francis. Yeah, it's very interesting, and it results in an intense experience of trying to parse through where things fit in. But it also creates like this kind of magic synergy that doesn't always that is independent of people playing in a room together. He's like, he had this vision and he like kind of knew where the parts were going to fit in, but he didn't want anybody else to know.
And that's why I think it's interesting to refer to, like, that you brought up how the Mars Volta is Omar and Cedric. The Mars Volta group is this time.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, I feel like a lot of people listening to this probably would maybe react to that being like, oh, he's kind of a prick, you know, he's just kind of like protecting, you know, he's a control freak, you know, and he's a little bit of a dictator maybe in that kind of a way. Which I think does beg the comparison between him and Roger Waters and stuff and people of that ilk. But at the end of the day, it's protection of vision as well, I think, you know, and I think that's why he did it. Very self-motivated, you know.
People like that have a creative vision and they more or less refuse to compromise.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
I
love that creative process. And as much as people, you know, can shit on Kanye West and everything, he has a vision.
Exactly.
And he's
going
to lead it out.
Yeah, a great way to... Yeah,
I love Kanye.
Exactly.
I think Life of Pablo is like top... top 10. I love that record. I think it's such an interesting execution of vision. And the dude, and I'm not a big fan of this guy's just trolling us. Like, mm-hmm. you know, we're not all Andy Kaufman, trolling people through their art, but it kind of seems that way. No one knows the mind of Kanye except for Kanye. He is only giving you what he wants you to know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's pretty genius. And you can call me an asshole or a Kanye West stan. And I'm not going to try to apologize for the Make America Great Again stuff, because there's a certain level of distance between Kanye as a person and Kanye as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, people like that are manipulative,
mm-hmm.
and they will show you what they want you to see. And you have to just look at people like Omar and Kanye. Is just like, they're setting trends all over the place. Like Kanye right. West, Drake's career doesn't exist without Kanye West making 808s and Heartbreak.
Oh, absolutely.
That's a fact. And I'm not the first one to say it. I won't be the last one to say it. And for the Mars Volta, there's a million bands that don't exist without this record.
We're getting to the end of the album now with the last song, but you hit it dead on. The influence that these bands put, because they're like, you know what? Fuck everybody else. I don't care what anybody thinks. I want to make the music that I want to make. I don't want you to put a bubblegum pop or tell me to not do an 18-minute guitar solo, mm-hmm. and, you know, put no vocal arrangement of melody, verse, chorus, bridge. I want to do it the exact same way I want to do it. And if I want to have Flea do a midsection bass solo, then I'm going to have it right in the middle of the frickin' verse.
Yeah. Funny you bring that up, because that happens in the song.
And let's take a listen to it. The last song on the album, Take the Veil, Serpent Text. All right, let's take a listen. I'm looking at Connor every single time to make sure I'm pronouncing these things right.
And then I think this song is very notable because it's maybe the only one, aside from the intro, where it gives some clarity as to what the fuck you just listened to.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? For it, for the narrative, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay, we just emerged from the Wonka chocolate river cave, and now it's like, and now you just see what they're talking about the whole time, outside of the psychedelic imagery and everything.
Honestly, this is my favorite song on the album.
Yeah.
I love it. I deeply, deeply love it.
All right, 8 minutes and 42 seconds in full for this album. Guys, I love this album. I think it's about that time mm-hmm. to give the rating of the Mars Volta, Deloused in the Comatorium.
Okay.
Now, the way we look at this with the new scale, we're taking away the 11 likes, we're doing away with that, and we're bringing on the Avenged 7 scale.
I'm so glad you used that.
That's God damn it.
So we're going to give it a rating of 1 out of 7, and then, as always, we're going to use our emojis at the end, so you can use 1 to 3 emojis, whatever you feel, to kind of express yourself a little bit better about the mood of this album. One of the greatest albums that this band has put out, again, the Deloused in the Comatorium by the Mars Volta, came out in 2003, and we're listening to it today. We're going to go to our two guys from NoCo Cinema. Tom, what is your rating for Deloused in the Comatorium?
Okay, so one, love the 7 rating because I'm just going to put this. You can cut this out later if you want to. But like, if you've never heard of the 7 scale rating, it's because it creates a true middle. There's the number 4. 4 out of 7 is a true neutral feeling, and then there's 3 negative and 3 positive numbers above that. So I think it's genius, and just calling it the Avenged 7 rating is
amazing. And when asked why we wouldn't do it out of 10 and when just using 5 as the true middle, the answer would have to be because 7 is just a sharper number.
Yeah, I like it. That's rude.
There you go. I didn't come onto this show to be fucking insulted, Michael.
I do appreciate that. And forever and now until the end of time, Tom and Connor, you guys are owners and proprietors of the Avenged 7 scale.
Shit. But I'm gonna give Deloused out of 7, I'm gonna give it 6 heart emojis out of 7. The reason I'm not going for the full 7 is because I'm going to say my favorite Mars Volta album is really Francis the Mute, which is the one that comes after it. I think it takes everything they learned from this and blows it up to a level that people might flat out hate. There is a 30-minute 7 movement, right? It's 7 movement finisher on that album, and it is absolutely insane. They pump up the salsa stuff and influences, but De Laus in the Comatorium is an album that everybody should have, even if you're not the biggest Volta fan. I think it's a landmark album of the early 2000s. It represents raw creativity at its best, and if you're into progressive music, this is a must own. So 6 heart emojis out of 7.
Wow. Okay. Strong rating. How about you, Connor?
I always hesitate to give things ratings. I don't know why, because if I really like something, I like to talk about it. And if I don't like something, you know, it's like what you learn from your mom. Don't say anything at all. But I do think that if I want to judge this album, I would have to judge it against other bands that the Mars Volta are like. And apart from, you know, passing similarities to Led Zeppelin and Santana and King Crimson and things like this, I really don't know if there is another band that's exactly like them or that is like them. So trying to compare them, I guess I would have to compare them against their other albums like you did, Tom. Mm-hmm. And I was going to give it a 6 as well, because I do think that this is their most consistent for like maybe just an average listener. Mm-hmm. But they do step up the Latin influences, and they really distill the vision of what the Mars Volta is supposed to be later years and later installments of their mythos, I'll call it. So I'm going to go with 6 heart emojis out of 7.
That's perfect. All right. So that was you guys are giving it really, really high scores, by the way.
Dude,
yes.
If there's anything,
you can tell there's meaning behind
it. We're biased as fuck. I mean, there's no way around that.
If there's anything you've learned over the last hour, it's that these guys are obsessed with this band. It is both of our absolute favorite bands of all time.
I love it. All right. So for the Mars Volta, De Laus in the Comatorium, I love what you guys, the knowledge you brought. I've learned so much more about this band. I'm going to go back home, read a few books on them. Maybe I subscribe to some Zines or some zines.
There you go.
Zines. Come on, Michael. Get your act together.
Zines.
Did you not grow up in Crystal Lake in the hardcore punk scene? But for
you know what a zine is. Come on.
For De Laus, I think the Mars Volta, they blew me away. It was the first time I heard this album from front to back, which is why I love doing this podcast. I'm a punk kid at heart. I love just the structure of guitar that they use in this album. But I need to keep it, you know, keep it steady, because we have a lot of albums to look at.
Yeah.
I'm going to give it 4 heart emojis.
Okay.
You're going to true neutral.
Yeah. True neutral.
Attaboy.
Yeah. See, there we go. That was the first use of the true neutral, too.
It's very useful.
Guys, thank you so much for joining us. Hey, where can we find NoCo Cinema and more on both of you?
Oh, yeah. So you can find all NoCo Cinema on WGNRadio.com, WGN Plus, iTunes. You can follow us on social media at NoCo Cinema. That's across all platforms. So Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, what have you. You can also follow us on a great social networking app for movie lovers called Letterboxd. It's like our favorite thing. I believe I'm T-Hush 237, so just think my name and then room 237 from The Shining. And then Connor,
I'm Serious Film Buff on Letterboxxd, and that's not a joke.
Yeah, no,
it's
that's
all undercase Serious Film Buff. And you can follow me, you know, on Instagram. You'd probably just look up my name, and you can find, I guess, my Instagram, it's Surly Nerbler, and Twitter, you can find me at Chint Gargans. I tweet, therefore I spam.
Is that the traditional spelling of Surly Nerbler?
Surly, yeah, okay. Like as in, you know.
Good.
Yeah. I'm a Surly man.
Surly Nerbler,
and then if you want to follow me personally, it's Twitter and Instagram, at Mount Hushmore.
Mm.
Guys, you two are the smartest people in any room that you walk into when it comes
true.
To either
true.
Movies or the Mars Volta.
That's it. Maybe.
And that's maybe. Where the line is drawn.
That's the line. Yeah.
Guys, thank you so much. You can find more about this podcast itself on WGN Plus. You search Sound Sessions. You can email me directly at Sound Sessions Podcast. You can find more information on myself at michaelheideman.com. Guys, thank you so much for joining us
thank
on
you,
the newest
Michael.
Episode of Two Dudes, One Disc.